From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. White House officials say President Trump will deliver a message of unity tonight when he gives his State of the Union address, which will be his first to a divided Congress. But with another government shutdown looming and both parties dug in over funding for a border wall, it is unclear what impact the president's speech will have. Joining us from Capitol Hill is Washington Post congressional reporter Paul Kane. Paul, the president almost didn't give this speech after the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi disinvited him during last month's shutdown. How would you characterize Trump's strength going into tonight?
It's the weakest moment so far for one of these big national addresses for him. He has never come into, well, let's just be blunt, he never has delivered an address like this with a Democratic House Speaker behind him. And that's going to be the visual tonight as Nancy Pelosi is seated next to Vice President Mike Pence. That alone is going to be a different dynamic than he's had before. The Democratic side of the aisle is going to burst all the way across to the Republican side because there are so many Democrats now. And the border standoff left him with sort of nothing to show for a 35-day shutdown. Overall, you know, his numbers moved a little bit, but when you consider that it was a 35-day shutdown and he got nothing in exchange for the shutdown, you know, he dropped a couple points here or there, but gosh, it still seems, though, as if he has this 35 to 40% of America locked in behind him. Mm-hmm. I think we'll have to see how he comes out of this, not just tonight, but next week as well. I think that'll go a long way to determining whether or not there really is a long-term drop in his base of support.
When we're reading reports that he's being warned by people like the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican, not to go the route that he's been talking about, which is to declare an emergency and just build the wall basically on his own without the approval of Congress.
Yeah, my colleagues, Sungmin Kim, Josh Dawsey, and Sean Sullivan broke that story about McConnell going to the White House last Tuesday and delivering that message saying it's a bad idea. And with McConnell, it's always all about politics and optics and strategy and tactics. So he's already gamed it out. If Trump declares a national emergency, there is a resolution that Congress can bring up, and the House of Representatives, now dominated by Democrats, they would approve that resolution, essentially rejecting the national emergency declaration. It is one of these privileged things that would come right across to the Senate, and within a certain amount of time, the Senate would have to vote on it. McConnell probably knows he's whipped this, and he knows that there are Republicans that would join with Democrats, and they would approve it. And that would leave Trump either having to veto this resolution, which would be his first veto, or get rejected by his own party. And that would just leave him in a bad standing. You would have lots of infighting among Republicans. McConnell just knows that that's not the way to go for something that would, in and of itself, just end up in the courts. And you'd have a long legal dispute as to whether or not this it would be a real national emergency declaration and whether it met with the Emergencies Act. And McConnell has sort of gamed that out in his brain and probably thinks, what's the point if, in fact, you're just going to go into the courts in a long shot case there and you divide the Republicans up here? There's no real benefit there. And with Mitch McConnell, it's always a cost-benefit analysis, and he sees very little benefit.
How will Republicans in the chamber receive President Trump's foreign policy message tonight? On Sunday, he said ISIS is 99% defeated in Syria, and he may tonight announce a second summit with the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un.
On the Syria issue, you will see sort of the divide between Republicans based really on worldview, and sort of the House Republicans are filled with many more people who are sort of in Trump's America First column. The Senate Republicans are the ones who tend to sort of be more in line with traditional sort of Reagan internationalist view of the Republican Party on foreign policy. I think that's where you'll see the sort of some people jumping up to support him, House members who are sort of allied with Rand Paul. But you'll also have quite a few senators who sort of maybe nod, very slight applause.
Paul, there was a moment in the last couple of weeks when we didn't know whether there was going to be a State of the Union address. And some people even said that would be nice. Maybe he should just deliver a letter and not give this big address. What are you going to be watching for tonight? What's the one thing that you want to see in this address?
Honestly, I want to see how this new class of freshman House Democrats, more than 60 strong, I want to see how they receive the president. How boisterous are they? How much, how strong a reaction do they have? Is there anything Trump can do that sort of wins applause from some of these rising stars that helped flip the majority? Two dozen or so that are in districts that he won in 2016, and they have to sort of navigate this balance of these freshmen. So that's what I sort of want to see. I want to see that sort of give and take in the chamber. And I think that will sort of go a long way to telling us whether or not Pelosi was right in her first move of delaying, postponing, canceling this, or whether it looks more like a traditional State of the Union and everybody is well behaved and dignified and civil toward one another. It's just a little fascinating divide out in the crowd tonight that I'm going to keep my eye on.
That is Paul Kane, a Washington Post congressional reporter. Paul, thanks so much.
Anytime.
Well, now to Virginia, where both of the state's chief executives are facing a chorus of calls to resign. Governor Ralph Northam has denied being in a medical school yearbook picture of two men, one in blackface, one in KKK robes. But he says he does regret wearing blackface on another occasion. Meanwhile, a woman accusing Justin Fairfax, Northam's lieutenant governor, of sexually assaulting her in 2004, has retained a D.C.-based law firm to represent her. Now, Fairfax has vehemently denied the allegations, calling them a smear to prevent him from ascending to the governorship should Northam step down, which he's showing no signs of doing. And as WAMU's Patrick Madden reports, for Northam and Virginia, this is just the latest chapter in the state's complicated racial history.
As Governor Ralph Northam delivered his inaugural address in Richmond last year, he pointed out over the crowd.
In a church on a hill 15 blocks from here, Virginia's first elected governor helped launch the American Revolution.
And yet, he said, at the same time, at the bottom of the hill, Virginia opened up one of the largest slave trading markets.
A place where Virginians would sell men, women, and children for profit.
Virginia's history, Northam told the crowd, was complex, good and bad. On one hand, it's the birthplace of American democracy, home to several of the nation's founding fathers. It was also the capital of the Confederacy and hub for the slave trade.
Well, Virginia is really at the fault line between the Old South and the Newer South.
Stephen Farnsworth, a political scientist at the University of Mary Washington, says Virginia has long struggled with how to come to terms with its history.
It wouldn't surprise me if this situation with Governor Northam leads to a kind of a greater reckoning of Virginia and its past.
Before getting engulfed by the yearbook photo scandal, Northam, like other politicians in Virginia, has tried to navigate the state's complicated racial history. He was born in Northampton County and graduated from a desegregated high school in 1977. He played on a predominantly black basketball team. During his run for governor in 2017, the issue of preserving Confederate statues was unexpectedly thrust front and center following the violence in Charlottesville. On one end, there was GOP firebrand Corey Stewart calling for Confederate monuments to be preserved as part of Virginia's heritage. On the other side, there were calls for the statues to be taken down from public spaces and dismantled. Northam tried to strike a balance, calling for the statues to be removed but preserved in local museums.
Personally, I would think that the statues would be better placed in museums with certainly historical context, but I am leaving that up to the localities.
Northam eventually won the general election in part because of strong support from African Americans. The boost in turnout among black voters, who supported Northam by a 9-to-1 margin, helped put him over the edge. Now, some in Virginia's black community say they feel betrayed by the governor, according to political science professor Toni Michelle Travis at George Mason University.
That somehow that person is who presented themselves in the election is not the true individual.
Travis believes it's a question of when, not if, Northam steps down. His potential successor, Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax, would become the second ever black governor of Virginia. Fairfax has also had to grapple with Virginia's past. 2 weeks ago, as president of the Senate, he decided to leave the dais in protest during the legislature's annual celebration of Confederate General Robert E. Lee's birthday. The reckoning over Virginia's past and muddled present continues in Richmond with all eyes on the governor's mansion. For Here and Now, I'm Patrick Madden.
New York Times reporter Abby Ellen fell for a Navy doctor. They got engaged. That much we know is true. He also said he captured Osama bin Laden, rappelled from helicopters to fight pirates, married his first wife after rescuing her from Iran, where she was a hostage. But they divorced. And that email that Abby found, in which he begged his wife to take him back, that wasn't real, he said. A therapist told him to write it to comfort his son. Abby Ellen is very smart, a natural skeptic, but what's your first thought when we tell you nothing except for the Navy doctor part was true? Are you thinking, what's wrong with her? Well, that's what Abby Ellen thought as she threw herself into the research on liars, the website dedicated to outing military imposters, fakewarriors.org. CareerExcuse.com, they offer fake background noises so you can call and lie about where you are. Abby discovered people with PDSD, post-deception stress disorder, and compared notes with her former fiancé's other fiancé and his wife, before concluding, yes, she might have been a little complicit, but why do we blame the duped? The duper was a jerk. The name of her book is Duped, Double Lives, False Identities, and the Con Man I Almost Married. Abby Ellen, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Wow, what a wild ride. First of all, take yourself back, because as you say, enough about the man you called the commander was true. He was in the Navy. He had been a doctor in Beverly Hills. He was trying to start a school for poor children in Afghanistan. That stuff was true.
That was true. And I met his son, who was 12, and I met his daughter, who was 5, and I met his 80-something-year-old aunt, and I met his brother and sister-in-law. I met his friends.
And you write, off you go, moving into the Watergate building in Washington, D.C., ground zero for deception.
That's, if you're going to be duped, yeah. Where do you live? Of course.
Well, but what, you know, he's telling you more things. He saved someone on the subway platform. You're a reporter. All along, you ask him questions like, really? I mean, I didn't see any reporting on that. Or, wait, your wife was a hostage in Iran? When was that? Because,
I did ask him these questions, of course. I said, what were we doing? When were we in Iran? Because the time didn't match up. And he said 1990. I said, that doesn't make sense. Secret mission. Undercover operation. You wouldn't have heard about it. Yeah. He slept with the lights on, and he had screaming nightmares. And I would say, why? And he said, well, I was held hostage in China. And I said, what are you talking about? When were we in China? Secret mission. You wouldn't have heard about it. So nothing was verifiable, and I was very suspicious, and I was always asking him questions, and he got mad at me about that. But I also thought, you know, somebody has to do these things, right? I mean, isn't that what we learn from Homeland and Zero Dark 30? I mean, like, somebody does this, so what better decoy than this little doctor guy, you know?
And you wanted the relationship to work.
Well, that's what it was. Yeah. That's also part of it, yes.
So it starts to unravel with Brussels sprouts. Explain.
So nothing was verifiable. I was at Johns Hopkins at the time. I was getting what I call my second useless master's in international relations. And I had professors there who were ambassadors, and they'd been presidential advisors. And so I asked them if it was possible to have medals for operations that were not officially in existence, you know, that we weren't supposed to know about. And they said yes. So I was trying to verify all along, okay, but nothing was verifiable. And I suspected something was off, but I didn't know. And I was thinking to myself, God, I'm just this mistrusting journalist, you know, skeptic. Mm-hmm. So we went out to dinner in November, this is 2010, with my parents in Washington, and we had Brussels sprouts, and he raved about the Brussels sprouts. And then they were happy, but they didn't really care, my parents, not like they had made them. And we got outside, and he said, God, that was one of the worst meals I've ever had. And I thought to myself, if you could lie about something so inconsequential and lie so beautifully, then you could be lying about anything.
Right.
And I was out.
You ultimately left him, and then not long after, you get contacted by the Naval Investigation Arm that was calling to tell you that he was arrested for writing fraudulent prescriptions for Vicodin and other drugs and using your name.
Yep. And I was elated because it validated everything I had thought, but I was also just, you know, also devastated.
Obviously, really. We've been laughing.
Yeah.
But it's somebody who was forcing you to live a lie. If you carry this through, these aren't relations you're having. This becomes sexual assault.
It's interesting you say that because there is a woman, her name is Joyce Short, and her whole mission is to get laws passed for sexual assault by deception, or what's called rape by fraud. If you do not know what you're dealing with, that's akin to some kind of sexual assault. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a forcible rape, but it's some kind of brutality.
Talk about the emotional, you know, the place where the heart lives. The whole time we feel this tug, too, until it's really too much to overlook, because you had loved him.
I did love him. Look, I was 42 years old. You know, I had run around the world. I had done what I needed to do. I thought, okay, I've never really wanted to be married, but it's time. So I met this person, and he was this nice doctor, and I thought, he's good, he's decent, he's kind, he's funny, he's charming, and he adored me. That's all very enticing. And so when everything fell apart, it was, you know, unpleasant.
It's shocking.
The other thing is that I beat myself up because I didn't know which way was up. I was gaslit. I mean, that is the term. You know, when someone tells you the sky is yellow and makes you think there's something wrong with you because you think it's blue.
Yeah, you were incredibly gaslit, as were the people who knew some famous dupers that you research, the British intelligence agent Kim Philby, who was a Russian spy, deceived his own family, Lance Armstrong, who you'd met, who insisted he wasn't doping.
Charles Lindbergh had three families, one here in the States, two in Germany, and then a third mistress in Germany.
Yeah. But also people not well known. You meet a man who fell in love with a woman at the office, thought she was going to be leaving her husband. They went on vacations together with their combined families, their children, and was lying the whole time.
7 years.
Used recordings to play behind her so that he would think that she was traveling for work or whatever when she wasn't. She was actually with her husband, who she very much loved. What do we conclude here? Because at one point you are asking about the commander. You and others are wondering, is he bipolar? Is it psychopath? Is it sociopath? Narcissistic? You determine that there are these grand liars, some of whom are sociopath, they don't care. Some who aren't, they do kind of feel bad about what they're doing. What is it?
Some people, yes, they are psychopaths, and they don't have any empathy, and they don't care, and they just spin tales. Other people are just bored, and they're really smart. They want to see what they can get away with.
Well, that brings us to another chapter in your life, because you have to start dating again. And as you say, you know, you meet a man and you tell people, everybody knows the commander story.
Yeah.
And you meet a man at one point, you say, well, who would mess with me after hearing that? Well, he would. You get duped again.
I sound like an idiot. I'm not an idiot. It's not that. This was somebody else who I met who was sort of well known in New York, and I adored him. He told me he was separated from his wife and that they couldn't get divorced because of their daughter. I mean, we went away together with friends. Again, it was the same kind of thing. I mean, it didn't make sense. But that lasted, you know, a few months, and then I was out. I mean, I didn't need to stick around.
I wanted to scream back at you as I was reading. No.
Abby, you moron?
No.
What were you trying to say?
No, I wanted to scream. No, it's them. You talk about that. Why is it that we blame the wife, Ruth Madoff? She wasn't the con man. Her husband was. We think of these people who do this. We make movies about them, and we exalt them. We say, wow, what a rascal. How funny.
Look at Catch Me If You Can. That was a book, then it was a movie, and then it was a Broadway show. You know, and Frank Abagnale, whom it was about, is now working with the FBI and helping to nail identity fraud. The thinking behind me when I was writing the book was, well, what about the people on the other end? How do they deal? How do they make sense of it? And yeah, it doesn't help that everybody else thinks you're an idiot. Mm-hmm. And they think that there's something wrong with you and that you're stupid and gullible and naive and all of those things.
Well, look, there's so much more. You go through all sorts of research about how you can spot a liar. But you also conclude what? Are you a sap?
No, I'm the farthest thing from a sap. I questioned this every day of my life. I was trying to navigate the waters between being a journalist and being a person. So my job and part of who I am in general, which is why I do this job, is because I'm questioning everything and I'm curious about everything and I'm fascinated about almost everything. So you can't be in a relationship and interrogate somebody all the time and be skeptical of them all the time. So the takeaway was actually, yeah, I have a pretty good gut. I just didn't follow it right away.
And as you found out, just about everybody who'd been duped had that same response. You know, I had a gut feeling, and they don't act on it.
Well, and it sounds so basic, but I have a chapter called I Knew But I Didn't Know, and it was all about these people who sensed something was off. I've just been getting all of these emails. I got an email from a woman who was with a partner for 20 years. Mm. She did not know that he had his wife around the corner.
That's Abby Ellen. Her book is Duped, Double Lives, False Identities, and the Con Man I Almost Married. By the way, where is he? And I'm hoping someplace far away, locked up.
You know, it's funny. He went to jail. He was there for about 2 years. Recently, I got a LinkedIn request from him. Mm. And what I think is that it was just one of those mass email blasts, you know, and he was just reaching out to everybody he'd ever met in his life. And I didn't accept it.
Yay!
Yeah, no, I didn't. You know, and this is progress because a few years ago I would have thought to myself, God, you know, maybe he can explain.
Abby, thanks so much.
Thank you.
British Prime Minister Theresa May told business leaders in Northern Ireland today that her Brexit deal will keep the Irish border open. This is the big stumbling block to the UK leaving the European Union because Northern Ireland is part of the UK and Ireland is not. Joining us now is the BBC's Chris Page. He's in Belfast, Northern Ireland. Chris, tell us about what Theresa May had to say today.
Well, she was trying to provide something, I suppose, for everybody, all sides of the highly charged debate around Brexit in Northern Ireland. She says she understands Brexit's creating real anxieties for people here. She said that, above all, she wants to avoid any hardening of the border. Says she also wants to avoid the need for any checks between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK, which has been a big concern of the people here who want to maintain Northern Ireland's links with Britain.
But wouldn't she need Parliament to agree to a deal in order to get those guarantees? And so far, she hasn't been able to get Parliament to agree to her deal.
Well, absolutely. This is the really difficult situation the British Prime Minister finds herself in. She says that she knows she cannot get a deal through the Parliament in London without changes to what's become known as the Brexit border backstop. Now, this has been the main sticking point in the whole Brexit process. The idea is, well, what Britain and the EU want to do is in future strike a big free trade deal, which means you don't have to check any goods coming across the Irish border. But what if that doesn't happen? Well, there is an idea called a backstop, a kind of insurance policy, if you like, that will mean that there isn't the need for any checks under any circumstances anyway, and that would mean that the whole of the UK remains aligned with European customs rules, and it also means that Northern Ireland continues to follow some EU rules on the movement of goods. So this is the main reason why the Parliament in London has so far rejected the draft deal that's on the table. They say the customs arrangement would mean the UK can't take on its own, negotiate its own trade deals. It would remain tied into EU trade deals. And also unionist politicians in Northern Ireland, the main unionist party here, are allied to Theresa May in Parliament, say that it would create, in effect, a border between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK, and that's not acceptable to them.
Chris, you're there in Belfast. Is there concern among people there, just ordinary people, that a hard border will come back, that the Good Friday Agreement is in danger, or do most people think they're going to work this out and it won't happen?
Well, I certainly think there are concerns. The closest we get to the 29th of March, which is still in British law, officially the date the UK will leave the EU, that as long as there's no resolution, no deal on the table, well, then we are looking at a situation where there could be a return to controls on the border, even though nobody wants that. The thinking is that if you do get checkpoints coming back on the border, if you get some kind of customs posts, you perhaps would then get members of the security forces having to protect customs officers who are carrying out those kind of checks, and that they could become targets for the remaining paramilitary groups who are small in number but are still intent on destabilizing the peace process. So there is genuine concern about that. But there is also, as you say, a sense that the border can't really be secured. It's too long. It's more than 300 miles long. There are 208 border crossings for a start. So there's a sense that because the border basically cannot be secured, well, the British government, the EU, are simply going to have to find some way of keeping it open, though exactly how they'll do that at the moment still very unclear.
That is the BBC's Chris Page in Belfast, Northern Ireland. Chris, thank you.
Thanks for having me on the show.
And that Brexit deadline is coming up next month. Lawyers representing students from Covington Catholic High School say they're considering defamation lawsuits against a host of media outlets and individuals. Students were harshly criticized online following that event at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington involving a Native American man and a group of Hebrew Israelites. That incident was more than 2 weeks ago, but there is still a debate on Twitter about exactly what happened. And our next guest says the story shows that Twitter is ruining American journalism. He wants journalists to stop tweeting. Farhad Manju is an op-ed columnist for The New York Times. Welcome.
Hi, good to be here.
So first of all, just lay out your argument. You say that Twitter is ruining journalism. How?
Yeah, I think it's doing it in a couple ways. One is just kind of ruining the image of journalists, because there's a lot of reporters on Twitter who spend their lives on Twitter, and we tend to treat it a little like a clubhouse. People just kind of offer their takes, their opinions on the news. And because tweets are short and they don't offer a lot of room for nuance, and because people are just sort of being reflexive, the interface drives us to, I think, not really consider what we're typing and how it looks, and things can easily be taken out of context. So one is sort of the image of reporters. Two, though, and I think perhaps more important, is that we in the press, even though we may not like to admit it, we tend to use Twitter as kind of an assignment desk. If something is big on Twitter, you know, we put it on cable news, we put it in the paper, we put it everywhere else. And I don't know, I mean, I don't think Twitter is sort of a reflection of the real world. And the problem is that we are all sort of stuck in it. We spend a lot of time there, and then we kind of take it as the real world and kind of look at what's happening on Twitter and make assumptions about what's happening in the rest of the world.
Well, I will say that, you know, as a journalist, I use it kind of as a wire service. I mean, you find out about something on Twitter, and then you can go and check with actual sources and see if it's true before you go on the air with it. But you find out about it. There's a lot of different voices coming in. And then you also tend to think, and I think this goes to the point that you were just making, that, you know, you're hearing reaction from all over the place. So it's almost like you were out on the street asking people what they think. But in fact, that's not the case.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it may have worked well that way at one point, but what has happened is that Twitter has become a magnet for activists, for marketers, for partisans of all kinds, for politicians, obviously. And so the impressions that you hear on Twitter are, you know, motivated for all of these reasons. And so you're not getting sort of the slice of, the American public or what the man or woman on the street thinks. You're getting kind of a motivated view. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult in the rush of tweets to figure out why someone is tweeting that way. Twitter's interface doesn't make it clear who these people are. You know, sometimes, you know, many times, tweets may become popular because they've been pushed up by bots, because they've gone sort of viral because of some, you know, Twitter mechanics we don't know. It's really hard to tell on Twitter why something is trending and whether it's trending for, you know, authentic reasons or for, completely made up reasons.
It's also kind of like a game where, you know, you let me think of a really pithy tweet to put out there to respond to this story. And, oh, look, I got 100 retweets or 1,000 retweets because of this thing that I wrote.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that is, I think, the worst thing about Twitter. And I say this as someone who loves that. I mean, I really have spent a lot of my life on Twitter, you know, during presidential debates, during all kinds of news events, where it became sort of a game. And you know, it's fun if you're in the news and you like the news and you follow the news. But I think that there, because it is a kind of a game where everyone's kind of competing to have the pithiest take on a thing, mm-hmm. it affects our thinking. I noticed that I was thinking in Twitter quips, and that's not really that productive unless if you're not aiming to be just a Twitter star and you're trying to, you know, produce good journalism in the world or try to affect the world in some larger way. Just thinking in Twitter quips, I think, is not good for you.
You've had some of your own bad moments on Twitter.
I mean, I feel like every day is a bad moment on Twitter. But yeah, I mean, I remember so many times there was that incident with that woman, Justine Sacco, whose tweet about going to South Africa was sort of taken out of context. She made a joke. Everyone kind of jumped on her about the you know, implicit racism in her joke, although I think people didn't get the context. She was on a plane going to South Africa. Everyone sort of pounced on it. I was one of them. There are many times where I've retweeted something that turned out to be not quite true. There are many times where I've had a very popular take on something that I, later on wish I'd reconsidered. And it's just, I think it's kind of unavoidable because to be good on Twitter, you have to be authentic. But sometimes, you know, authenticity doesn't work with the kind of higher calling, you know, of journalism to be thoughtful and nuanced and to report and to, you know, just kind of get a better and more comprehensive picture of the world.
Another thing that I wonder about when I watch journalists, because I follow mostly journalists on Twitter, is that there are people who I respect and I think do great work in their news organizations. And then I see them tweeting all day long and I'm thinking to myself, how is this person doing any reporting if they're spending all this time coming up with really clever tweets?
Yeah. I mean, one reason is because it's just really fun. There's an addictiveness to Twitter. I found that was the case for me. I mean, my job is to write columns, and I would write three words and then check Twitter, and write three words and check Twitter. And now that I don't have that compulsion anymore, I mean, I'm sort of better in all parts of life, even at my job.
How much of Twitter's influence do you think, and how much it's used right now, do you think has to do with the fact that the President of the United States uses Twitter constantly to send important messages to the public, and that he's basically put the presidential stamp of approval on this platform?
I think he has something to do with it, but I would imagine that if he stopped tweeting, nothing about the rest of how journalism works with regard to Twitter would change. I mean, people in the news were using Twitter more or less this way 3-4 years ago, mm-hmm. before Trump came on the scene. But you're right, he has put this, you know, the seal of approval on it, and it does make it justifiable for reporters, especially political reporters, to be on there because the tweets and the responses to the tweets are the story now, and the way that, you know, other politicians respond to Trump happens on Twitter. I mean, every political story now is just, this is what happened on Twitter today.
So your message to journalists is that they should stop tweeting so much and do a little more maybe just lurking on Twitter. It sounds like you're saying there's no way that people would just get off it altogether, but maybe they can take the first step, which is to spend a little less time on it. Do you think that is realistic given where we are right now in 2019?
I think it's realistic, but I think it's difficult. I mean, my path away from Twitter has been difficult and on and off, because it's really is a big part of the news. And if you're, you know, a news reporter or just tied to the daily news cycle, you can't really ignore it. The way I use it now is I check it several times a day. I mean, before I used to check it like several times a minute. So mm-hmm. It's a huge change. And I use an app called Nuzzle, which sort of creates like a kind of digest of what has happened on Twitter, you know, in the last few hours so that I can kind of keep tabs on it that way. And the other thing I do is I'm just much more deliberative about deliberate about what I post. Like I type out a lot of tweets and then I don't post them. Like I just sort of save them to drafts. And there's something a little bit, it's like Nicorette gum. Like it sort of satisfies the urge to tweet, but I don't actually post it and like change the world in any way.
Well, at least you still have another platform that's pretty big called the New York Times. So there's that if you decide to get off Twitter altogether.
Yeah, I mean, and that was one of the criticisms of my piece, which I think is legitimate. Like, journalists who don't work at the New York Times, journalists who are just breaking into the news business. I mean, it definitely worked for me that way. Like, I think that Twitter became a professional network for me. It's my profile on Twitter is one reason that I advanced in my career. I think Twitter is important in the business of journalism. And if you don't work at the New York Times, it's much harder to decide not to tweet or to pull away from Twitter. Mm-hmm. I definitely recognize there's a sort of a position of privilege associated with my take there.
That is Farhad Manju, op-ed columnist for the New York Times. And we'll link you to his piece about this at hereandnow.org. Farhad, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
What would a Trump voter want to hear from President Trump's State of the Union address tonight? Well, let's check in with Kim Dowdle of Birmingham, Alabama. We speak with her from time to time, including after last year's address, when, Kim, you said you were glad there weren't any wince moments. Welcome back.
Thank you. Absolutely. No wince moments is what we're shooting for.
That's kind of a low bar. So let's see if we can raise it. And let's be honest. You have told us you did not vote for Donald Trump because he's a politician and you enjoy some of the comedy, but you sometimes feel he goes too far. Let's get right at the issues.
Yes.
What will you think if he uses this speech to battle again for taxpayer funding for the wall, especially given that he campaigned in front of people like you on Mexico paying for the wall, which, of course, we all know Mexico is not. So should that be his focus tonight?
You know, I think it's going to be his focus. I don't think it should be. I think that America is probably sick of hearing about it. If he really wants to surprise people, he will take a totally different road. And he'll go on, not that the wall doesn't matter, okay, but he'll go on things that Americans are really pressed on, like healthcare and education. I do believe he's going to hit the wall pretty hard, but I don't think he should.
Well, I want to pick up on some of the things you just said, but staying just with the whole idea of immigration for a while. And by the way, the Democrats say they want money for fencing and barriers and things, but there's better technology. And they also in the past have wanted a path to citizenship for the so-called dreamers, people who were brought here illegally as children. And this is in the past, not now. But there's been a shift in people coming across the border. There are not as many young men. These are largely women and children escaping violence in other countries. What about that kind of, you know, trying to maybe get to one of the entry portals to get asylum? What's your sense there of a path to citizenship?
Asylum is definitely an issue, and that needs to be addressed. You know, immigration within itself is a very complex issue. It's not a straight build the wall, stop people from coming. I know that that's how people think it's going to be. And I think that we need, as a general population, a win. And the win needs to come through safety and security. And part of that is illegal immigration. And part of that is asylum from horrific things that people are going through. I mean, the violence against women and children in every other country is disgusting.
Listen, I want to pick up on some of the other things you said, because it's interesting. You said you want to hear about healthcare, education. In recent polling, most Americans put improving healthcare at the top of their list, followed by jobs. There's gun violence, combating climate change. What else do you hope for from the president tonight?
I would love for him. You know, I was talking to someone yesterday about healthcare. She's a nurse, and I asked her what the most frustrating thing about her job is, and she said to me, Medicaid and Medicare, and the unawareness that patients have when their policy is concerned. She wished that we had patient education and financial education.
You're saying you want to hear him talk about investing in healthcare education?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that is the number one reason why people complain about their health care.
Well, and some of the things Kim Dowdle of Birmingham, Alabama, a Donald Trump voter in 2016, wants to hear from him tonight. But mostly, Kim, no wince moments.
Oh, gosh, please, no wince moments. This is probably going to be, honestly, the most pivot point in his administration is tonight, just because of all of the moments leading to this.
Well, speaking of which, in a week or so, if he does not get the funding that he wants for the wall, do you think President Trump should shut down the government again over that, or even use the military funding to build it with an executive order?
No. I do think that there needs to be, and you know, I'm in the South, so I'm going to use this. We call it a come to Jesus meeting here with not just the Republicans and the Democrats, but literally like everybody needs to come to Jesus. And that means get the chip off your shoulder. Let's be honest. Let's be for America. Let's be unified. Let's get something done. This is ridiculous.
You say you want everybody to unite, but this president has used some of the most divisive words ever heard from a president in, you know, blasting people he doesn't agree with, name-calling them. Do you think people will believe him tonight?
I think that this is another reason I think it needs to be done where you can see someone. You know, anyone can write a letter. Anyone can
tweet
and say something, but write. Oh, my Lord. Yes. But it's very, very pertinent to see someone's face when they speak, because 90% of what we say is not through our words. And so I think it's going to really depend on the sincerity of the deliverance, to be honest.
Kim Dowdle, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
And Kim is a Trump voter, and we've spoken to her before and will again. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.